This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. President Trump wants local law enforcement agencies to take on a greater immigration policy role. McLean County Sheriff John Sandage says he's not expecting changes.
Seeking people in the community? We don't have the manpower to do that, and I don't think that helps promote trust.
Sandage thinks border cities will manifest most of President Trump's deportation efforts. The sheriff updates the situation. Hear about efforts to bring greater diversity to labor unions. Judy Valente talks with Alvis Martin, the chief lobbyist for the Chicago Laborers Union. He spoke this week at Illinois State University. And John Norton talks with singer-songwriter Nick Africano, the next performer in the Duncan Manor Songwriter Series. That plus a GLT news update on the way. It's March 2nd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from the Jack Batal Real Estate Group. More information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. In January, President Trump signed an executive order on travel and immigration that included measures to ramp up a program known as 287G. That program deputizes local law enforcement officers to double as federal immigration agents. His order is, of course, caught up in the court systems. The president says he's planning to reissue the order, which could again include 287G. A report released by the Immigration Legal Resource Center in December found that the overwhelming majority of more than 2,500 counties surveyed in the U.S. didn't need formal programs. They were already offering assistance to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, the Department of Homeland Security's immigration enforcement arm. John Sandage is the McLean County Sheriff. He's responsible for the jail where people arrested anywhere in the county are first incarcerated. Sheriff, thanks for coming into Sound Ideas to offer some clarity on what's going on locally with immigration enforcement. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Mike.
In a story that can be seen at WGLT.org, you told Charlie Schlenker on February 15th you didn't expect current policies regarding immigration to change. What are those current policies at the county level?
We're currently still operating under the Priority Enforcement Program, which replaced the Secure Communities Program, which they're looking at going back to. And under that, there wasn't a whole lot of changes. It's actually more lenient than Secure Communities was. And what we do, anyone arrested for a criminal offense, we send their fingerprints to the FBI. The FBI then forward those on to ICE Homeland Security. And if they feel that it's somebody that they want, they will issue a detainer or a warrant for them.
Someone is arrested, brought to the jail. Walk me through that process for someone who looks like me and someone who maybe looks like they're from another country. Is there a difference?
No. There is. We do the same booking procedure. Now, if there is chance that they weren't born in the United States, they will be asked where they were born, and that may trigger other information being sent. But everybody is fingerprinted, and all those fingerprints are sent to FBI.
So help again. We're here to add some clarity to the situation. If a legal immigrant or an illegal immigrant hasn't been fingerprinted in the past, has had no criminal history, it might be difficult for the federal authorities to know who this person is one way or another. So there would be no hold issued.
Absolutely.
When and how would ICE be notified? Is it through the PEP program?
Yes. And it's not through us. It's FBI that forwards those prints on to ICE.
So what is your understanding of the Trump administration's new guidelines for deportation of undocumented immigrants or any of the guidelines he's issued, his executive order?
They're still kind of up in the air. I mean, I think they're kind of broad. That's why we're not looking at changing anything we're going to do. It appears that they're going to take a stronger look at all crimes that are committed rather than just the priority crimes that are outlined in the Priority Enforcement Program. But until there's clear-cut understanding and direction, we're not changing what we're going to do.
John Sandage is McLean County Sheriff. I'm Mike McCurdy at Sound Ideas. We're talking about immigration policy. There's been discussion by the president that if his plans move forward and officers aren't enforcing immigration laws, communities could be considered so-called sanctuary cities and risk the loss of federal dollars. What do you think of that approach?
Well, I think it's a give and take. I don't think withholding funding is a good idea, because I think that kind of penalizes some people who had no say-so in decision-making.
For instance, law enforcement.
Yes.
In San Francisco, for instance, a lot of the federal funds that go to San Francisco, which has already declared themselves a sanctuary city, some of that federal money goes to support law enforcement, which had no decision-making,
right.
no process. They weren't really involved in that decision.
And I think that's one of the things that will be excluded from funding, is any type of funding that supports law enforcement. But there's, let's just say there's a lot of things that need to be worked out.
Sure, there's a lot of hypotheticals at this point,
right.
But if push comes to shove and McLean County, Bloomington Normal, stands to lose federal dollars, where do you think you might fall on using local law enforcement officers as immigration officers?
I don't think you'll see that. First of all, you're not going to see McLean County or Bloomington Normal become a sanctuary city, I don't believe. We still cooperate with ICE and the Priority Enforcement Program and sending our prints in. So we're not refusing to do that, which some jurisdictions have done. Now, as far as sending officers door to door looking for people based solely on the fact that they are in the country illegally, we don't have the manpower to do that. And as I've said before, that's not a good way to build trust with the immigrant communities. We still want these people feeling comfortable calling the police if they're the victim of a crime, and not being afraid that, oh, if we call the police because we're a victim, we're going to get deported.
So you think in terms of local law enforcement, stepping up immigration enforcement can have a detrimental effect?
Absolutely.
Detrimental effect in terms of communication or people reporting a crime?
Absolutely. Now, if it's someone who's committed a crime and they're wanted because of that, we're going to cooperate 100%.
You've talked about resources and manpower, that there maybe aren't enough dollars to make this happen. What if you had the monetary wherewithal?
I still don't believe in it. It's still, like I said, affecting the relationship we have with that community. You know, we will cooperate 100% on the jail side, and we will cooperate if there's somebody out there that has a warrant that's, you know, a serious felony, something like that. But as far as someone seeking someone based solely on their immigration status, no.
I think you're right, based on my discussions with local leaders, that there are no plans to declare Bloomington Normal or McLean County a sanctuary city or community. But my understanding of what the Trump administration is saying is that if you don't play ball, we're going to consider you a sanctuary city anyway and cut off funds. That's something that you would oppose.
Yes, but I think we are playing ball, because we are honoring the Priority Enforcement Program.
You told the Pantograph in January that you don't agree with Trump's positions on every issue, but you welcome the new president's support of law enforcement. You were a Trump supporter during the campaign. Based on Trump's rhetoric during the campaign and the executive order on immigration, why shouldn't the immigrant community be concerned with how you or your office could handle them or their community as it concerns immigration?
Well, first of all, I separate the two. My political preference, I don't let that influence the way I run the sheriff's office. Sheriff's office is run for the good of all the citizens in McLean County and for the safety and security and protection of those folks. So I keep my political viewpoint out of it. That was a personal thing, and I think it's pretty narrow-minded to think that just because I support a candidate that I agree with their whole platform.
But somebody in the community could make that connection. You're saying they shouldn't.
Correct.
One local immigrant who is legal but whose family members are not described herself as a ball of anxiety to GLT, as we reported on this issue, over the new Trump administration's policies. Do you think she has reason to be worried?
I really don't. I think there is a lot of apprehension in this. But I think where you're going to see the major areas of enforcement are your larger communities and possibly your border areas. I don't think that McLean County or Bloomington Normal is high on the list of priorities for immigration enforcement.
Back to the PEP program for a moment. You send those fingerprints off. What happens if you do get a hold, or if you do get notification back that they want you to hold somebody? And have you seen an increase in that since the Trump administration took office?
We have not. In 2016, we had 28 detainer requests. Now, there has been some controversy lately on whether the detainer alone is enough to hold that person. So what we have seen lately is a warrant accompanying that detainer request.
And for what kinds of issues have the detainers been, what was the reason behind the detainer?
They've mostly been criminal issues.
But not the fact that they were in the country illegally?
Correct.
So how do you see all of this ending up? Where do you think it's going? I mean, you're involved in day-to-day law enforcement more than the people listening, so we're asking for your expert opinion. Again, an opinion, but where do you think it's going?
I think it's going to be a long, drawn-out process. First of all, for him to get all his enforcement priorities, there's a long line of things that need to happen. There's federal agents that need to be hired. There's detention facilities that need to be built. There's immigration judges that need to be brought on board. So I think you're looking at a long, drawn-out process that, it could be past his term.
And it could also get tied up at the Supreme Court level. You're talking about, you know, the hiring of federal officers. Wouldn't it be more economical for the feds to use local?
Locals don't have the manpower. And, you know, we owe it to the taxpayers of McLean County to protect and serve them and not tie up our resources on a federal program like that. And now we will assist them 100% on other issues. But when it comes, if they're looking for us to go door to door seeking people on the basis of their immigration status, I don't believe that's a good use of taxpayers' money.
Going back to the campaign and even after the Trump administration took over from the Obama administration, do you think the anti-immigration rhetoric is healthy for the country or this community?
No, I do not. I do not. Don't get me wrong. There are some issues, and I think there's issues. We do need to secure the border. There's a lot of drugs coming across the border. There's a lot of bad people coming across the border. But I don't think that it needs to be a shotgun approach. I feel like that's what's happening.
In fact, the truth of the matter may be we don't know who's coming across the border. They may be good or bad. We just don't know.
Exactly. And, you know, we're living in a different time right now. I think things do need to tighten up for the safety and security of our country.
Okay, Sheriff Sandage, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
John Sandage is McLean County Sheriff. He was elected in 2014 and has served with the Sheriff's Office for a total of 26 years. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Drake and Nancy at Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC, offering 26 years of experienced, reputable, and timely financial management with a contemporary, independent perspective. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The nation's major unions and African Americans have not always enjoyed a harmonious relationship. While it's true that some union leaders like Walter Reuther of the United Auto Workers were prominent in the civil rights movement of the 1960s, some unions today remain largely white organizations. Alvis L. Martin, the chief lobbyist for the Chicago Laborers Union, is trying to change that. Before speaking this week at Illinois State University, Martin sat down with GLT's Judy Valente for a conversation about the history between organized labor and minority workers.
The actual major change is the fact that the UAW was a major player back in the 50s.
United Auto Workers.
Yes. They were a major player. They came in and they supported civil rights. They understood that there was one thing that was most important, and that was if people worked, If people had the right to select and right to choose in working, they were going to be prosperous. And so if you keep any segment out, then you are devoiding the whole thing. Okay. So the UAW and under Walter Reuther was one of the best things that ever happened. Walter Reuther came in, he supported Dr. King. He then turned around and they put money behind Dr. King. And then they brought blacks in to the union.
Ever since the 1970s, unions have lost a lot of ground. They've lost a lot of power. How has that particularly impacted African-American workers?
Well, you know, we talk about, especially in the trades, okay? Again, apprenticeship programs, the inability to train people, black people, for jobs. Getting close to what's happening in today, we hear this all the time because blacks are just not getting jobs in the trades.
Who is getting them?
Well, where the elderly workers are now retiring, dying, their sons, their nephews, who have never had any experience, are getting these jobs. And for black people, it constantly keeps us out of the mix. We're not there. We're not given the opportunity.
What do you see as the future relationship between labor and African Americans? Where is it going?
Well, thank God for Donald Trump. We're in a position now where everybody's coming together, regardless of class, regardless of color.
Okay, I think you're saying thank God for Donald Trump with tongue in cheek.
With tongue in cheek.
Okay.
Simply because he has ignited this country, contrary to what people say, how the divisiveness. I don't care about the divisiveness as much as I care about the fact that people are now coming together no matter what the issue, no matter where they stand. They are coming together because they don't like what's happening. Right now, they're pushing for a national right to work. National right to work will spell a death knell for unions.
Meaning
yes,
you do not have to join a union.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, many people would say that Donald Trump is actually fighting for more jobs in the trades, more low-skilled jobs in America, not being exported. What do you think about that?
I think, in all honesty, the jobs that Donald Trump is talking about are low-wage paying jobs. America is not going to build itself. I mean, remember, it is the middle class. Because they had unions, because they had the ability to get a livable wage, were able to build this country. We're not going to build a country with everybody working at McDonald's or Burger King. It's not going to happen.
What about the commentaries you sometimes hear coming from African-American leaders saying our jobs are being taken from us by immigrants and almost supporting or adding fuel to this anti-immigration feeling that seems to be swamping the country?
I think it's a real terrible thing that we would have our leaders saying that, you know, immigrants, particularly Mexicans, are taking jobs at African-Americans. There are jobs that some African-Americans are not going to work regardless. Okay, they're
like,
just not going to do
that. For example,
well, I'm not going to be a dishwasher, no matter what. I'm just not going to do that. But I think that what we have to start looking at, as far as the black community is concerned, is that we put pressure on people to train our young, to give us an opportunity, getting into the trades, if that is the case. Every black child grows up thinking he wants to be another Michael Jordan. He wants to get into some athletic thing that's going to lead to the pros and millions of dollars. It does not happen. And so when we send our kids to school, we're not training them anymore to become skilled artisans. They're not coming out to be that person who can actually take care of his family.
Well, you're from the Chicago area, and you know that there's a tremendous problem in certain neighborhoods, largely African-American neighborhoods, with gangs. Why are the gangs there? Largely unemployment, bad schools. How can labor help address some of those problems?
The Chicago laborers right now has what I believe one of the greatest programs in the Chicagoland area. They built a new training center up on the northwest side. They are bringing in, we have at least 3 African-American instructors. We're bringing people in. The problem is there's no jobs. You send people through school, you train them, but then they're not employable because there's no work.
What's the answer to that?
Well, I think one of the things that has to happen in the legislature in Illinois is that they start looking at, and this is with the black legislators especially and the Latino legislature, they should be looking at how we can put teeth in these public contracts, all of these things that will say this guy has to have 30% minority participation. And not only just say that he has it, but then go back and make sure that he's doing it. That's what has to happen.
I want to ask you about Dr. King and his relationship with labor. What was his impact on the labor movement?
It was a necessary. Both sides, labor and civil rights, actually knew that if they coexisted, if they marched at the same time, if they kept the common goal of ensuring that workers would actually have the right to work, that they would have good wages, that they would then be able to advance in the cause of both. So you end up with a great push from the civil rights movement to join with the labor movement and say, look, labor has the money. Labor could put money behind the civil rights movement and help advance the workers. Dr. King was in Memphis for the sanitation strike, and he was killed.
Right.
So there was this whole thing that no matter what, my people will be better when they have the opportunities, when they can work.
Do you think African Americans are interested in unions? I mean, do you really think that they are joiners for unions?
You know, sadly, and this is really, it really bothers me because I'm a union person through and through. But what bothers me is the fact that all the advances in the fact that people were able to get jobs, they were able to sustain themselves, has been pushed back because a lot of people want to tell you, you don't need a union. What is a union going to do for you? Well, the union protects your wages. It protects your benefits. It ensures that your working conditions will not get you killed. That's the bottom line. But there are so many, this whole sentiment across this country right now is that unions are no longer necessary. They're thugs. You know, that's all they've ever been. They're not there to really help you. And I truly, truly don't believe that.
Where do you see the future of African Americans and unions going?
One of the things that I'm excited about, the fact that a lot of us have advanced in union leadership, that we are, you know, board members, we're presidents, we're out there in the mix. I just hope that this whole thing about right to work does not go over, because then we won't have nothing to talk about. We're through. It'll be over with. But I think that black people have an opportunity, and in some of the particular unions, they are moving and advancing into leadership positions. And because of that, I think it's fantastic.
Are there some unions where African Americans are farther along, say, in leadership roles than others in some trades?
Yes.
Rather than others?
Yes, definitely. And one I spoke of right away was the Laborers Union. IBEW is starting to advance more and more African Americans in those positions.
International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Exactly, exactly. They're moving real well to advance people, you know. And we have those that are not, okay, because there have been stalwarts who held out for so long. It's almost like, I can't change this. I can't do different.
For example?
I hate to really put somebody out there, but, you know, there are low numbers in some of the trades, like the pipe fitters, boilermakers. These unions are way, in my opinion, somewhat behind with their advancement of people of color.
And so in some unions, it is a fact that jobs are passed on from father to son to grandson.
No question.
And that's a barrier for,
yes, it is.
For minorities.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You know, we've gone through that for years now. You know, you can go in a union hall and a guy will say, well, you know, I'm going to retire next month. Next month he's gone, his grandson's there. Now, I don't have a problem with nepotism, but when you say nepotism, it's okay for you, then it better be okay for me. I better be able to do the same thing. I should be able to invite and help my people, my relatives, anybody that I know, get a job.
Let's talk a little bit about the economics of African Americans in labor. What do they bring to the table, so to speak?
Well, when we talk about the economics, I guess I really mean, how do we get it so that everybody gets it, that everybody gets an opportunity at a career and the ability to raise their family, take care of their family? I mean, that's what we live for every day. We're not going to live for that doing a McDonald's. You know, minimum wage is not going to get a family in a healthy situation by no stretch of the imagination. The only way for us to move forward is for us to get people trained. You know, in Chicago, when I was growing up, we had public schools that taught auto mechanics. They taught plumbing. They taught electrician, everything. And then at the end of the middle of the 80s, they stopped. They centrally located one school, sent everybody to that school who wanted to go. And that was the end of it. And so as a result of that, and I always say this, is that it leads to the drugs, it leads to the gangs, and it leads to the killing.
So are you advocating more vocational education?
No question about it. We have got to bring the trades back into the schools. If we could get into the public schools and start talking to sophomores, juniors, and seniors and get them interested in what the laborers program is about, maybe then we can get some of these contractors to hire some of these kids for the summer and let them see what the possibility is. You know, we woke up one day and said, all our kids got to go to college. Well, you know what? It's not going to happen. And we have to understand that. This is across the board. This is not just a black issue. This is an issue for America.
But do you think African Americans are going to be interested in those kinds of jobs, carpentry, boilermaker, electrician? Perhaps they want to get that education because that, too, was denied them for so long.
And I say to that, fine, let those who have been identified as those who want to go into a four-year university or anything else, let them go. But what I say is this, you have to give kids some options. See, we have to be able to say to them, you should know how to build a deck in your backyard. And wouldn't you like to know how to do that? We need to give them the tools to work with. And if we don't do that, we're going to have more kids on the street.
We've been talking with Alvis Martin. He is the chief lobbyist for the Chicago Laborers, talking about African Americans and labor. Thank you so much for talking about these issues.
Well, thank you, Judy, for having me.
I'm Judy Valente.
The right to work without union representation remains a hot-button issue in Illinois. In a case that could have ramifications for the entire state, the Illinois Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit recently heard arguments in a suit brought by two state employees who are challenging the fees that they are required to pay unions. Right-to-work attorneys for the two employees have vowed to bring the case, if necessary, to the Supreme Court. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. I'm contributing listener Kat Woods. Let the GLT news staff know what you think of this show by posting comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can also tweet. We're at WGLT News. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, you'll hear from singer-songwriter Nick Africano. The singer is up next at the Duncan Manor Songwriter Series, and John Norton has that interview coming up during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Hatfields and the McCoys, the Montagues and the Capulets, there's no denying the appeal of a good, juicy feud. And premiering this Sunday on FX, it's a new limited-run TV series that peeks behind the celluloid at one of the most talked-about feuds in Hollywood history. Laura Kennedy has more.
Bette Davis and Joan Crawford couldn't stand each other. In fact, Davis once said of her Warner Brothers rival, "I wouldn't piss on Joan Crawford if she were on fire." Theirs was a bitter dislike that stretched through the years and now has made it onto the small screen with the new miniseries, Feud, Bette and Joan. The show revolves around the filming of the classic movie Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and details the conflict between the sworn enemies. Jessica Lange is Joan, and Susan Sarandon plays Bette. GLT culture maven Sherry Zeck says this miniseries demonstrates our deep and abiding love affair with celebrity.
You add into that that we are also generally as a culture quite taken with conflict of all sorts. So you put celebrities having long-standing arguments. I'm trying to resist using the word feud right away. But long-standing dislike or disagreements in these public lives that they lead, together with our love of celebrity itself, and it's a great combination. After all narrative is really at its heart about conflict.
Day five, I get to kick her right in the head. I can't wait.
So Bette Davis and Joan Crawford hate each other. Already you have the beginnings of a narrative because you've got the conflict between them. Now, the thing that's curious to me about this particular upcoming show, Feud, is I teach film, and
And I'll bet your students don't know who Joan Crawford or Bette Davis are.
That is exactly right.
That's what I can't get about this, is why they're making a series about film stars that a lot of young people, maybe even people my age, would be going, you know, huh?
And I think they even largely don't know who the actresses are. They might know Susan Sarandon, not necessarily Jessica. This one, we'll see if it's a hit or not. I attribute this to some extent to the fact that because we have so many channels, and because we have such a broad need for content, and because we have such a wide range of viewers demanding that content, I mean, of course, advertisers, they want that 18 to 24 range, or that, to stretch it out a little bit, 12 to 30 range of the spenders, the people who spend on popular culture. But there's money to be made even in elderly folks who, you know, if the TV breaks, they fix it immediately, right? Uh-huh. So we're so attached to what can come to us through our narrative, through our televisions, that I think that that need for content means there are pockets of interest that various channels can afford to address in more specific ways. And if they get lucky, it catches on beyond that.
How extraordinary is it that we have two aging actresses playing two aging actresses in a TV series? This is not something we see every day.
No, it's pretty unusual. Here we are getting to women who are 60 or pushing 60 or somewhere above 60, somewhere in that range, playing women who had very, very, very long careers.
Bette Davis looks old enough to be my mother, and so dreadfully overweight. Joan Crawford has slept with every male star at MGM, except Lassie.
And also, if people look at films of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, even when they were in their 30s, they probably look a little bit older to today's audience, mm-hmm. because of hairdos and styles and those sorts of things, which tend to look older to today's audience, even if they're on young people.
Nobody had Botox back then.
That's right. Well, they had other stuff, but yeah. So you put all that together, and those actors of those former years, I think, always seem old to today's audiences. Even their earliest films are seen through the light of their latest films. They had incredibly long careers. They made hundreds of, sometimes over 100 movies. So the fact that the people playing them are a little bit older is not all that interesting to me, save that these are a couple of good actresses who don't get as many roles as they did 30 years ago.
So why do you think? I mean, what was going on between Bette and Joan in real life? I mean, I understand they were probably competing with each other for roles, but they had so much in common. They were very strong women. They both had like four husbands. They had troubles with their kids. And they had so much in common. It just would have been so much nicer to see them team up and support each other. Instead, they were feuding.
The thing about Davis and Crawford is they were very different actors.
Lose the shoulder pads.
I beg your pardon.
And cut back on the lipstick. You're playing a recluse who hasn't seen the sun for 20 years.
Davis was, she was really a better actor. Joan Crawford wasn't that good of an actor, and Bette Davis knew it. At the same time, Bette Davis got lots of accolades within the industry and outside for what a good actor she was. So I think there was some professional jealousy there. But also, they both came from sort of rougher backgrounds. But Bette Davis always kind of played that tough role to mm-hmm. some extent, even in her early 30s films that were also glamorous. She was sort of the tough girl, glam girl. And Joan Crawford really embraced the glamour itself. And so I think there was some disgust on each other's part about that, both seeing themselves and each other and seeing themselves having gone in a different direction in each other.
Part of me is a little queasy thinking that this might give us a cruel portrayal of the middle-aged woman, that it's just like, yay, old babes catfighting, kind of a cruel aspect to that.
I'm anxious to see this feud thing because it seems to me it is a fictionalized take on a real relationship that became more interesting for its original fictionalization in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. So being able to look at this real relationship without seeing it through the lens of Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which I think is the real genesis of feud, mm-hmm. is going to be very tricky. And I think that's one of the things that made people love Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, is because it was these two old broads thought to be past their prime, past their beauty point, going at each other in the most cruel and horrific ways. I had nightmares after that film for months.
Of course, Bette Davis got nominated for an Oscar for her performance.
Well, she was great. And of course, Bette Davis had a lot more years in her after that, too. I mean, she continued making films, some of them mostly for TV, but she continued making films for another, 15 or 20 years.
What does this type of show have to say to us and about us? What are the lessons in something like this?
Well, I think one of the lessons is to begin looking for its inverse. For all of these stories about great rivalries, there are other stories of friendships and the way women held each other up, and it would be nice to see those made into films too and be as interesting as these stories of bitter rivalry and anger. I think with these two figures, there's also just a certain level of delight because of the petty and ridiculous ways they would get at each other. So I wouldn't want to say that one can take lessons from this in how to be a petty, nasty person.
Or how not to be.
Or even how not to be. But I'm not so sure this is a good thing. But we do have some icky, to use a technical term, some icky interest in seeing how low people will sink and in knowing that even the wealthy, the famous, the hugely successful can still be ridiculously low and cruel. I suppose in some way there is something comforting about that, that however someone might have a life that seems so out of reach from the rest of us, full of accolades, money, glamour, travel, Hollywood, staircases, stuff, that they still can be somehow more rotten people than we are. We can still feel a bit superior to them. I suppose there is something of that in there. People don't just love TV shows for the TV show themselves. They love it for the conversations they have with their friends later, the water cooler thing, right? And the great thing about a feud is that you can take sides. The success of this thing, I think, will hang on. Does it spark those conversations later between folks of, well, Bette Davis was right. No, Joan Crawford was right. So it's the back and forth that we get to have in taking sides and kind of reenacting this conflict, probably in a friendlier way for the most part, in our own conversations after the show's over.
That's Sherry Zeck, Associate Dean of the College of Fine Arts at Illinois State University and GLT's Culture Maven. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Feud, Betty and Joan premieres on FX Sunday at 8 p.m. You're listening to the 1981 song Bette Davis Eyes. It's singer Kim Carnes on Sound Ideas.
Takes to make it pro blush. All the boys think she's a spy. She's got Bette Davis eyes.
Kim Carnes on Sound Ideas here on GLT 89.1 FM and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Maybe humans are what happens when high intelligence evolves in an animal that also has hands, and dolphins are what happens when more extravagant intelligence evolves in an animal without hands.
Close encounters of the earthly kind.
That was unbelievable. I was waiting. Oh, that was so cool.
That's on the next Radiolab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Brad Barker Honda, where the service experts have more than 200 years combined experience. Whether it's routine maintenance or a problem, Brad Barker's qualified technicians can help. Current service specials available at bradbarkerhonda.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The Duncan Manor Songwriter Series continues this Saturday with the return of Nick Africano to Central Illinois. This graduate of University High School currently lives and works in New York City and is working on songs for a new album. He's recently sat down in the GLT studios for a chat with John Norton about the pleasure and pain of writing songs.
It's one of my favorite things. And I think it involves a little bit of both. If we're talking about the spectrum of pleasure and pain, both in the process and in the content, I guess. As much as maybe at times songwriting has been therapeutic for me in a way, it has ultimately become something that I take great pleasure doing.
When did you start writing songs? Were you real little? Were you writing poetry? Were you writing songs? Did one evolve into the other?
I started writing stories and poems first when I was very young. And the first time I tried to write a song was when I was 17. I started young, and I started backwards. I didn't learn anyone else's songs before I started writing my own, which now I'm learning how to go backwards and learn everyone else's songs. And then write my own.
So what was your first song?
Oh, man. What was my first song? I think it was a song called Long Road. There are a few people in this town who will remember that song.
You recorded it or you performed it too?
I performed it with friends. My friend Dan Hubbard and another friend of ours, Felipe, played saxophone. This was back in high school.
So do you have a recording of it anywhere?
Man, I don't even know. I don't know. I don't think so.
No, you want to forget about that one?
No. That was the beginning.
That's really cool.
That was the beginning.
I don't want to ask you what your favorite song is that you've written, because nobody likes that. These are all your babies. I get that. I'm sure that's what you'll say. But is there a song you're particularly proud of? Is there a song that you've written or a couple of songs that you've written that maybe have a great backstory to them or a real unusual way they even came to be?
That's a great question. So I sort of, by answering that question, I'm going to answer your first question as well. You know, what was your first song? So I wrote a song when I was 22 years old, and I ended up performing that song at my mother's funeral. So that was a unique stage.
Mm. What did you write it for the funeral?
I had been writing it beforehand, and it then turned into a song. It took a turn when my mother passed away, and it became a bigger piece, and it was about my mother, but I kind of consider that my first real song.
Well, or not, it was too early or late, time followed behind us, as if to mark our fate, knowing how long we had both tried to wait, before spending this last moment we would share.
That set a new standard for me. Something happened with that song where it was my new standard to match.
What's your favorite song that you didn't write?
My favorite song that I didn't write. You know, I've been thinking a lot about that question, because I'm in the process of learning tons of covers right now, just to stretch my imagination. One of my favorite songs right now is "Visions of Joanna" by Bob Dylan. Another one is this song called "Cucurucucu Paloma." It's a Mexican song. There's a version by Caetano Veloso, Brazilian mm-hmm. singer-songwriter, and it just kills my heart.
Ay.
tama. Ay, 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 gemía.
You like Brazilian music?
I do, but it's
because that spans the spectrum so much. People think bossa nova or sambas, but man, there's some great Brazilian rock music and soul music and
yeah, there's a lot of cool kind of underground stuff, and I'm just getting into it now. So my knowledge of it isn't that great yet, but it's kind of stretching my imagination.
So you started writing your own songs before you learned other people's songs, which is usually backwards from the way it is.
Yeah.
Why are you going into it? Why are you learning new songs? Why are you learning other people's songs now?
Well, I think we as songwriters, artists, get into certain patterns, certain comfort zones. And I really want to push my ability right now. I think that I have some really good songs in the works. It's one of the reasons I'm home right now is to take a minute outside of New York City and focus and kind of listen to what's going on inside myself, and I really want to stretch my ability and stretch my comfort zone.
You know, you're getting to one of my questions I was going to ask, I guess. Nick Africano is who we're talking to, by the way. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. You moved to New York City in what year?
It was 2008.
Okay. Is there a difference in your songs that you've written here in Central Illinois and those once you moved to New York City? Do you write about different things? Do you think about things differently? Or do you just bump into other artists and songwriters and that changes how you view things?
I don't know if it's that I write differently there or anywhere, but having lived there for so long has inspired me to get better at what I do, because you're around a lot of people who bring their best every day, and you go to a club and you listen to just a random singer-songwriter you've never met, and they blow your mind. And that can happen anywhere. It's just the sheer volume of that city. You're around it and it makes you want to bring your A game. Thematically, I think that thematically, you kind of inevitably are affected by the energy of New York City, for better or for worse. Sometimes it's just distraction. Sometimes it's kind of an overload, but it ends up in my songs somehow.
Have you risen to the challenge?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely made me better.
Give me an example.
I tell you who I've run into is singers in New York and recently in Nashville. And not even necessarily that they have a big name, right? But you show up and you hear someone sing who's a man or a woman, and you think, oh, wow, they're really singing. They're not just using their voice as a means to tell people their lyrics. They're really singing a melody in a song, and there's a quality to their voice that they have worked on, or maybe they just have it. You know, that has been inspiring to me.
In a number of interviews that I've read with you, a lot of people ask you about advice you would give to people breaking into songwriting. And your general answer has been, write songs, just keep writing. Can you stress how important that is when you want to really make it in the business, that you've got to have your own songs?
Well, let me answer. I think that's two parts.
Yeah.
I think if you want to write songs and perform songs, write, perform, keep improving, you know? And I have to tell myself that every day as well. You know, there's no way to get better in front of people unless you're in front of people. And there's no way to get better writing unless you're writing and reading and soaking language in. But I don't necessarily think, you know, to have a career or to do what you want to do within the music world, you don't have to sing and write your own songs. A lot of people are writing for other people or singing other people's songs and have a lovely career doing that. But if you are a singer-songwriter or you're interested in writing your own material, I think you have to always write another song. Hold yourself to higher standards all the time and keep changing.
Well, Nick Africano, it's nice to meet you in person. See, you brought your guitar with you.
That's true.
Can we talk you into probably playing a song since you brought your guitar up?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you have on your mind?
I'll play a new song.
Something nobody's ever heard?
It's a song that's not recorded. Maybe I've played it once in town. So not many people have ever heard it.
Okay. What's it called?
This one doesn't have a name yet.
Not yet.
It's going to most likely be called Angels Walk With You.
On a new album that's coming out soon, maybe?
Hopefully, yeah.
Okay. All right, cool.
So here we go.
Twin City native Nick Africano talking with GLT's John Norton. Africano is back in town from New York City to play the Songwriter Series this Saturday night at Duncan Manor, just outside Towanda.
Feeling unready, well, dizzy, unsteady. Well, each step feels weighted with loss. Sometimes the bridge is bound to break. Just when the distance seems too great to fall, sometimes the only choice to make is to step out and risk it all.
Africano performing a currently untitled song in the GLT studios. He's playing the Duncan Manor Songwriter Series on Saturday. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the interviews and stories thanks today to Judy Valente, Laura Kennedy, John Norton, and Willis Kern at our website, WGLT.org. Also thanks to McLean County Sheriff John Sandage for his time today. Our website is where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast. Post about the show at facebook.com/WGLTFM.